spending, as I indicated, because of the number of companies that wanted to travel and go on our arcade missions. And also we've been expanding the range of missions we've had to the DRC, Cuba, Iran, and so on. There's overexpenditure on that one, and so on. Our critical infrastructure, finally, as I indicated, that money should be spent now quite soon because the BSA will be undertaking those construction projects in these old industrial parks and so on. Then finally, to conclude then, just some of our key challenges at the moment. As I indicated, our funding pressures are building up for our incentive programs, where we are now getting a increased application for MSEP, film and TV, for EMEA and for automotive. I must say the automotive incentive schemes, although this is a sign of success because we are getting investments, as I mentioned, we had VW. We are now getting another big one from Mercedes-Benz. We're getting a very big one from Ford, and we also have one from BMW. All of them undertaking expansions. And as you can see, again, on the front page of Business Day, our president walking hand in hand with Angela Merkel. Germany has prioritized South Africa as a major destination. They currently have 600 German companies in South Africa employing 100,000 people. And they're saying they want to expand that relationship, and they're making some big investment. 600 companies employing 100,000 people, and that there's a statement by the German ambassador, which he published yesterday, where he's calling for a deepening and a strengthening of the relationship. And as I said, they are our biggest players in the automotive sector. And they have given a commitment that we already had the infamous VW, which expanded, but we're also having the other ones, especially BMW and Mercedes-Benz also. So that puts big pressure on our budgets because now you get a flood of requests, which, as I said, is unprecedented. We usually get one or two a year. Now we have even Ford from the US wanting to build an engine plant in South Africa. Malebo has a big problem. She has too many applications and too little money and a treasury which is tight. So we have to constantly manage our cash flow, because we don't want to chase away these investments. It's been something we've been for years been busy with. Now that they come, we must ensure that we try to find creative ways of dealing with it. So that's our biggest challenge at the moment as a department, is the number of applications we're getting in film and TV. It's the same thing. So just every company now making films in South Africa. The biggest macroeconomic challenge, as you know, it looks like the U.S. will be putting up interest rates. And if the U.S. puts up interest rates, it means dollars and money starts flowing back to the U.S. And all emerging markets, even if you're as powerful as China, the dollars flow back to the U.S. and that puts pressure on your currency. So that's our biggest challenge, and that's why we may even have interest rate hikes in South Africa, even though our economy is growing slowly, there's no inflation, but because the dollars are flowing back to the U.S. So that's our biggest macroeconomic challenge. Commodity prices, again, as I said, we are still, the bulk of our export comes from commodity prices, and that decline is showing rating. And so we have to double our efforts to diversify and industrialize so that we have a broad basket of exports rather than just relying on raw materials. And then, as I said, finally, we do face a significant challenge in the steel industry, where we have Evra Steel under liquidation. Fortunately, there's some good investments coming into that area. But also we are putting in place a support package for the steel industry, which, as I indicated, included the tariff. There's now anti-dumping duties under discussion. And then finally, we are starting to designate steel products. And so those are our challenge. Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, EG. I should have given the apologies that we had a late apology from the Honourable Hill Lewis, who will be arriving at 9:30. Thank you very much, EG. Now, just before we go across questions, etc. I want to point out that we said we would have completed this at 9:20 originally, when we were going to complete the program. An hour later, we had this at 9:40. So we must allow some questions and clarifications. And I must say, that is a lot of good news, notwithstanding some of the challenges that you have alerted us to, Gigi. Thank you. But I'm now going to look at members and give them a maximum of 3 minutes each. Honourable MacPherson, that's all I see. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman Gigi. With regards to the MCEP problems, this is not something that we didn't foresee. This is not something that we didn't know was going to happen. In fact, in March this year, when we had a committee meeting, when we tabled the number of applications and the value of those applications, it was quite obvious that the program was going to be oversubscribed. And I remember the discussion that we had was that the department was going to go back to the Treasury and ask for more money. I know you went and did that. The problem is that the department didn't come back to us and say the Treasury had said no. Because if that had happened, DG, we could have then looked at the adjusted budget and how do we then, if a committee, we choose to reprioritize the funds that were being made available to us. That option wasn't given to us, and I think that, I don't want to think it was deliberate, but I think it was a major oversight on behalf of the department of not communicating that message from Treasury back to us. But I still think as a committee and as a department, we need to sit down urgently and work out how do we ensure that those applications that were made up until March next year are funded so that we don't stall the growth in manufacturing that we are seeing. I want to commend you on the decision on 12. I think it's the right decision. I really do hope that that's going to be fruitful. You know, Didi, you've cited the success of the textile industry, and you're correct. It was a dying industry 10 years ago. But governments then took some very deliberate and conscious decisions on why it needed to save the industry because of the amount of jobs that were in it originally, but that could also be created. If the government can do, and if the department can do that with that industry, we need to look at rolling that out into other industries and being deliberate in supporting other industries like we have. And we know they have the support of the government. The union bought into it. Businesses bought into it. The major retail chains bought into it. So we should never believe that, you know, local manufacturing can't work. It can work, but it needs the deliberate support of government to stop the, you know, illicit rubbish imports, you know, that we're affecting that and the constant undermining of the Chinese with respect to that. So I think that there's an opportunity across manufacturing to replicate that sort of deliberate support. I just want to find out where we are with respect to the preferential procurement by local government and provincial governments, because they are still the biggest non-compliers when it comes to preferential procurement. And you know, I still keep in touch very much with my local municipality, which is Itakwini, and you know, hardly by anything that is local. So I will keep saying if we need to have an audit finding in terms of local procurement for every department that exists within governments across the three spheres. I just want to pick your brain on one last thing with respect to international trade versus human rights and reform. And I want to use Iran as an example. You all know that Iran has one of the worst human rights records that exist on earth. They are oppressive towards freedom of speech, journalists, opposition parties, homosexuals, children, women, you name it, they are oppressive towards them. How do we link the reform of human rights to bilateral trade? Because to go to Iran and say we want to do business, but you can continue to act in the way in which you do, is not in our interest, and it's certainly not in the people of Iran's interest. I would just try, is there a discussion or a thought of how we link those two? And I know that it's not up to us as the DTI to determine those reforms, but Is there a discussion with DERCO or the presidency about, you know, how we link those two issues? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kuren.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions. One is the platinum sector. I know we know they're going through a very difficult time. Is there anything, you know, the department can do to assist? You know, it's not fashionable to have a platinum jewelry because it's so cheap now. And, you know, the recycling industry with regard to platinum. Are we investing with regard to that, yes or no? And do we see a future for platinum, for platinum industry in South Africa? And then secondly, the route. Agricultural processing industry, you know, have you done a study to see what the impact will be with regard to the drought?
Honourable Colonel, is there any other member who wishes to raise a question, comment? No. Right. DG, over to yourself, please.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Let me then deal firstly with Honourable McPherson. I think thanks for you, for those really. I think you've captured it well about the support for how we can reuse the clothing and textile as an example. And I think you're absolutely right. The reason it worked because of the collaboration with business, government and labour all being on the same page. Because that's the biggest problem in anything is where the three parties don't see eye to eye. And that is when problems happen. And as I said, it is a story that we want to roll out. As we indicated in our annual report, four sectors we have now proven that you can, where the three sectors, the three parties collaborate, where you have good resources and you have a very smart plan, it can work. We've done it with automotives. We've done it with clothing and textile, we've done it with foam, and we've done it with BPS sectors, and so on. The key strategic objective, I think, on the way, is we agree we need to now roll it out to the new sectors. As I said, to oil and gas, chemicals, advanced manufacturing, locomotives, shipbuilding, even aerospace and defense, and so on. So I think we definitely, and we will collaborate, and I think where we can get your support, that will be appreciated and get all these sectors now onto the industrial policy program, because as you know, it's only through local production, because I mean that's what GDP means, the amount of services and goods you produce every year. So if you're importing all those goods, you are transferring jobs. So growth is really dependent on us reviving all of our local sectors. So I think we agree with that. And then as you indicated, the one was the 12i, and we welcome that. And on the MSAP, I think yes, we did have an extensive engagement, and I think we regularly will keep you updated about the incentive programs, how we're doing. As you know, we are in weekly discussions with Treasury on our incentive program, because as you know, it's one of 8 incentives we manage, and as I said, all of them face that problem of oversubscription, and then we have to also do Shabiri. We have to juggle. What we introduced a few years ago was to move it between incentives, at least to have the flexibility. If we have oversubscription in phone this year, we can take from the BPO and give to that one so that we manage our resources. As you say, if we get a big investment from VW or BMW, we're able to at least sort them out this year, the next, and we take from the clothing and textile fund and so on. So that is the big juggling exercise, and I think I'm apologies if we didn't come back to the committee in time for all those discussions, but I think we'll definitely, as I indicated, that's our biggest issue, is where we keep you fully briefed, and then you can also assist in trying to ensure that we get increased. What we're going to have to get is increased budgetary allocation to incentives. Because remember, the clothing textile didn't come cheaply. It's about R1 billion a year that we pumped into the clothing industry to drive that industry. After a time, it is possible to scale down the level once you've attained your competitiveness. But in that initial period that it requires, and especially now in the climate of a tight fiscal policy, this is a challenge, but thanks, I'll go back to you for that. With regards to the international trade, as indicated, the policy we adopt is basically we are all members of the international community, South Africa has always, in its policy, has a very, very strong focus on human rights. The policy we adopt is to follow the United Nations to the letter. If the United Nations introduces sanctions on every country, we immediately implement that in our trade missions. For example, in Iran, because of the sanctions increase, we closed the DTI office there and we moved our representative, which was based in Iran, to the US, to the UK. So we suffered big because we had to withdraw from Iran, and as I indicated, it is a very, very good market that we do that. But now United Nations have cleared Iran. So, as you know, everybody is in Iran on a daily basis, right, from the US to everybody taking these opportunities. Fortunately, we have a slight advantage because we have historical investments there and so on. But as I said, so we follow a simple principle about United Nations. We don't believe in unilaterally deciding on which country we trade with or not. As you know, Saudi Arabia is also accused of human rights abuses on a periodic basis. We cannot implement unilaterally any sanctions against Saudi Arabia. So I think it's a simple thing about the United Nations. And as a member of the international community, we will take our cue from the United Nations and so on. I think, Honorable Kuenov, I think you're right. The biggest issue is the platinum. And as you know, South Africa shifted from gold to platinum as our most important resource. And that is the one which is suffering the most because it is mainly used in the auto catalysts in cars, and because of the drop in demand for cars in the US and in Europe, we use these sort of carbon, low carbon emission vehicles. We've seen a drop in demand for platinum. The strategy there, and this is actually the main thing of the operation Kisa, which is currently underway in Limpopo, is the platinum industry. So there's a total consensus from South African government, the mining industry, and the downstream beneficiation industry to work on a strategy to revive the platinum industry. And I can say that there's very good discussions taking place at Bakisa around the long-term future looks very positive, because as you could see the statements from BMW and one other major manufacturer, Toyota, the future of vehicles is the electric car. They say by 2050 most cars will be electric vehicles. It is highly likely that they will use platinum-based fuel cells in those vehicles. So in that sense, there is demand. So as we say, that this industry does seem to have a future, so we have to position ourselves to be there. As Peter would say, yeah, no, go long on, go long on, Longman. And then on the drought, we've been engaged, and Minister Quinty has dispatched an emergency teams of officials to the drought areas. So the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development officials are busy in those areas. As a DTI, we have been asked to convene a meeting of the finance institutions, both of DAF, Rural Development, the Land Bank, and other agencies, and getting assistance from Malebo, where we are trying to see how we can divert some resources towards the drought-stricken areas. Because if, as I said, there's no use trying to grow the agri-box if people don't survive the drought. So there is going to be an attempt to see that we shift the incentives which would go on for normal agro-processing or agricultural activities to actually just to the drought-stricken areas. And a meeting, I think it's in this week, we've been asked to assist with that meeting, but it is getting the full attention of the ministers. Honorable Chair, that covers the bulk of the question.
Just a minute. Thank you very much, DG. We really appreciate that. And I must say that we just want to acknowledge the other members of your team here. We see you've got, the Group Chief Operating Officer, Jody Skult, here. We've got Mr. Shabir Khan, the Chief Financial Officer. I think we may have Ms. Malebo Mabiti-Thompson here, yes, DDG IDAD. Ms. Poppy Quena, Director, Office of DG. Way down there, right, good thing you shook your fingers. And Mr. Raymond. Yeah, I can't see anyone down there, you see, thank you. Mr. Raymond Gundala, Deputy Director, CCRD. Welcome, Mr. Abisha. Did you find us? I see. Right. Acting DDG IDD. I'm sorry, I didn't have your cell to warn you of the relocation. Thank you. Then we have Mr. Raymond Gundala, Deputy Director, CCRD, and Mr. Liso Stefor, Acting Chief Director, BEE. Right. We really want to thank you, DG, for taking the report back to the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee of your performance, the performance of the team in DGI. We do appreciate it. Thank you very much. There was a small point which we will ask seen in an email for further clarification on the incentives, which I would have thought would have stood at about 50% at this time, but they're standing at about 75-76%. Right. And I say, members, you know, the issues around the AGOA, to which the DG referred to, as we pointed out last week ourselves on Friday, there was no need for gloom and doom or the Khoor-Khafar tactics, which, unfortunately, the media pursued to the bitter end, and to the point where I thought, you know, we may be facing an economic war, but of course I knew we weren't. This is normal negotiations. And I was very pleased to see the announcement by the trade minister from the United States, the embassy there, that absolutely not. He's as confident as I say I was, and so is the minister. Everyone involved in the negotiations directly is confident that there will be a positive resolution. Thank you. Now, we're moving on speedily to, well, not that speedily, but to the National Gambling Board. And let me welcome Ms. Caroline Hongwa. We're really getting to know you, Ms. Hongwa, aren't we? Accounting Authority there, and Ms. Tereshka Makadut. I believe it's some special festival today, Diwali, and when I saw that beautiful outfit, I wondered what you're doing here, but I must say we appreciate you taking the time from a very important spiritual festival to be here with us. I don't know how many Christians would be here on Christmas Day. You know, I'm just wondering the dedication. But we do. And, of course, isn't it the celebration of light? So maybe you'll be bringing us a lot of light from the National Gambling Board this morning. Right. But it's a very beautiful thing, and your whole demeanor is expressing your excitement and joy. Right. And you're sharing it. Thank you very much. Over to you, Ms. Hongwa.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm here with the Chief Financial Officer, Tereshka Makadas, and only the two of us from the National Gambling Board. We'll be giving you an overview of the gambling sector performance as of September, and then the results on gambling prevalence and problem gambling research that we undertook earlier on in the year, and also the performance against the business plan, action risks and report against the post-audit implementation plan and the financial report. Just to begin, in terms of our executive summary, we had 17 targets that were reported against the entity's annual performance plan. And as of Q2, we've achieved 100% of the targets. And this was also the same situation in the first quarter. The entity has been able to improve with regards to its performance compared to the previous financial year. And then we've been focusing also on our role regarding curbing unlicensed gambling activities. We'll go into detail through the presentation. We've also been dealing, linked to that is the, we've been dealing with the Illegal Gambling Operators Register in collaboration with law enforcement agencies, specifically the HOF, and identification of syndicates in the Gauteng province. NGB has also been able to undertake evaluations of compliance in terms of the National Gambling Act. It has been the responsibility of the NGB to ensure that provincial licensing authorities are complying with the standards set out in the National Gambling Act. So for the first time, we're able to conduct on-site inspections, which are basically take the form of an audit, and we check in terms of process, norms and standards and criteria, how the provincial licensing authorities then award licenses to operators who then apply. As you are aware by now, the National Gambling Board has no licensing power, so we oversee that. And then we've also continued to report on the national gambling statistics, market share and conduct of the various modes of gambling that we oversee. We also conducted research on the prevalence of gambling and problem gambling. This has been a follow-up study. The last time we looked into this was November 2012, and we've continued just to track and analyze the trends in terms of prevalence of gambling and problem gambling, which is another responsibility of the National Gambling Board. And then going to the annual audited gambling sector performance, that's on slide 4. In Q2, we ordinarily present the audited statistics. The statistics are only ready in July, so we ordinarily report on them in Q3. But just to give you an overview, I think at the previous meeting we also presented this, but it was based on raw data. So we now have the auditor statistics, and we're just confirming in terms of gross gambling revenue for the financial year 15, which stood at 23 billion. And then casinos continue to be the highest contributor of gross gambling revenue, followed by the betting sector, followed by the limited payout machines sector, and the least contributor then stands at the bingo sector. And then followed by that is basically a provincial overview. Yes, again, Gauteng remains the highest contributor at 4.2%, followed by KwaZulu-Natal and Western Cape at 15.8%. So this is what we usually track each quarter. And then as at end of Q2, we've also just gone ahead and we've continued monitoring the quarter one sector performance. In quarter one, we have casinos yet again maintaining the highest position with regards to percentage contribution at 17.1% of GGR. And the trends basically remain the same. Followed by the betting sector, that's the tolls and the bookmakers, and then limited payout machines and bingo. And then from a provincial overview, there's not been much change as the annual overview. Gauteng continues to lead, followed by KwaZulu-Natal, and followed by Western Cape. And then in this quarter, we decided to also give you an indication of specifically the LPM sector. NGB specifically is tasked to maintain and establish a national central electronic monitoring system. So basically, in terms of this system, it gives a specific account of how the LPM industry is performing. Why we've also included this, which we don't ordinarily do, is to give you an idea in terms of the national LPM distribution, which is the percentages that you see on slide 8, the provincial proportion as was set out in the regulations. So in terms of the limited pellet machine regulations, there is 50,000 limited pellet machine allocation for each province. Now, if we go over to slide 9, which gives an indication of the percentage per province in terms of rolling out the machines, why this is of importance is specifically if we look at Limpopo. Limpopo is a 72% rollout of the national allocation. In terms of the regulations, when any province in terms of phase one reaches 100%, then it's incumbent on the NGB to undertake a socio-economic study, which then you have to table before the minister. And the minister then has to give consideration whether that particular province will be entitled to continue to roll out further LPM machines and license more operators. So we are just giving an indication that in the following financial year, we will be looking at undertaking a study for specifically the Limpopo province. Following is KZN at 55%. Why we're looking at KZN at 55% is they have currently licensed over 55%. However, they have not rolled them out. And according to their projections, is the moment they roll out certain LPM machines, they could be reaching approximately 80%. So they're currently considering the rollout, and they have formally at this point put in a request for the National Gambling Board to conduct the socio-economic impact study. And then, so that's the overview of the LPM sector. We also undertook research regarding the gambling prevalence and problem gambling. On slide 10, we basically give you an overview of what the results are in terms of trends. Gambling participation had increased from 14.3% to 15.3% over the period of review, that's April 2011 to April 2015. And then national lottery participation has increased from 77.0% to 78.9%. And then illegal gambling has seen a significant decrease from 41% to 17.5%. Now, what ordinarily the research target is, you'll see as from the slides following, there's basically qualitative research that's conducted with the sampling from the South African population and also from the gambling population. So these are just basically trends and findings that have been tracked over time. And then we have 54% of gamblers who may be considered as no risk, and it's a significant increase from 43.4%. And then 9.9 gamblers may also be regarded as problem gamblers, and this has decreased from 20.2%. It will reflect clearly as we go to the following slides. And then there's also a finding that illegal gambling has the highest risk of people becoming problem gamblers. There's also an indication that there's a slight increase in gambling across both genders of the South African gamblers population. And then the rest basically give an indication in terms of racial categorization, age, and then also the areas where problem gamblers have decreased, which is both in the metro and non-metro. On slide 11, we basically give an indication then over the past 12 months how the trends have decreased. And then that's from November 2012 to April 2015. There's been certain decreases in gambling incidences. And then if we go over to slide 12, This just gives you an indication in terms of the participation in gambling activities as at April 2015. National Lottery remaining as the most preferred amongst the gambling population, and then we have scratch cards, casinos, lucky draws, horse racing and sport, bingo and limited payout machines. And then illegal gambling continues to stand out from what has been indicated. Although there's been a decline, we are still concerned regarding the prevalence, and as I indicated earlier, we still continue to thrive to deal with unlicensed illegal operators or basically illegal gambling activities. On slide 14, we have on slide 14 we basically have an overview of the research results on problem gambling. So that basically the blocks just indicate in terms of the lighter yellow, the no risk, and then the no risk, low risk, moderate risk, and high risk. Here our significance is basically to indicate that amongst the South African population, and then the sampling done from the South African gambling population, this shows basically a decrease with respect to problem gambling. We see there from 2.7% to 1.5% and 17.5% to 9.9%. We're not privy to the reasons exactly why, but it's just basically an indication of the trends and how then they are moving. And then going on to slide 15, this is basically just gambling activities broken down in terms of level of risk. And here, as I've indicated earlier, the sample size of these findings is basically 50 as at April 2015. So in terms of the activities, what was considered was illegal gambling and the trends, casinos, scratch cards, and national lottery. I think of particular interest and concern, whilst there's an increase, according to the findings, to begin with on illegal gambling, there's an increase of no-risk gamblers. However, the high risk also still maintain a high level. If one sees closely, you have no risk at 32.2% when it comes to illegal gambling. However, you have 30% high risk, so that's of concern. The same reflects with the casino industry, where you sit at 38.9% of no risk, but then you still have a high percentage of those who are at high risk. I think the ideal situation, or ideal balance, would be the National Lottery, where you'd have a high no-risk individuals partaking in this gambling activity by choice, and then a low percentage of high-risk individuals. So this is just basically what the trends are reflecting in terms of behavior. And then our key challenges and proposed actions continue to remain the same from the previous quarter. We have taken time to ensure that in terms of public outreach and initiatives, we do participate. We participated in collaboration with the DTI on a seminar on online gambling, basically, and recently also we are to collaborate further on compulsive gambling. This is done in conjunction with the DTI. We've also taken time to hold a seminar with the law enforcement stakeholders on curbing online gambling. So there are certain initiatives the NGB have undertaken over the past two quarters to deal with challenges with regards to reaching out broadly in sections of the community. And then we still have certain capacity constraints with regards to skill that we're trying to recruit and retain specifically to supplement in terms of prevention and detection of illegal gambling, that's basically in the enforcement section on the inspectorate section. And then we've continued to meet with stakeholders regarding the confiscation of unlawful winnings and the amounts in terms of what has been confiscated have increased. And then the following slides basically give an indication of the specific performance indicators and the milestones and the achievements that the NGB has undertaken. That's basically the report against our annual performance plan. Just moving on to our post-audit implementation plan, there's been improvement here after the Auditor General's audit. There's improvement, significant improvement in the previous financial year there were 134 findings. In the 13-14 financial year, NGB had 134 findings. In the 14-15, which is the previous financial year, we've stood at 34 findings, and thus far, as of September, 24 have been resolved and 10 are outstanding. So there's improvement in terms of internal controls. And then going on to financial performance, the NGB has spent 32% of its budget as of September, and then we have a cash balance of 2.4 million at hand. Included in that amount is 4.7 million of the unlawful winnings, which we are currently under investigation, and we're hoping to take these matters to court to apply for final forfeiture of these winnings if I found that they are basically unlawful winnings. Unlawful winnings, just to remind you, would be winnings by a gambler who is well excluded as a gambler or a minor. So basically, that's what we look at for someone who is undertaking online gambling activities. So we focus on that. We have a positive variance in terms of our personal costs due to vacancies. We have moved forward in terms of the filling in of vacancies. The details are outlined in our report. However, there are certain positions in the enforcement function where we looked for specific skills that we didn't have a good response, so we are yet to re-advertise. And hence this amount stands huge. And then in terms of professional fees, this accounts for basically the research that we've undertaken. So just to go back to the 32% spending, in terms of what we would have committed by the end of quarter three, we can assure you that we would have committed about 77% of the budget. So while it, yes, reflects the 32, which is not quite a good reflection, we should be, as of September, at about 50%. We have had certain procurement processes that we had to undertake, and those monies have been committed, and spending will begin as the service providers begin working. There are certain processes also that preceded the procurement process, which was consultation with provinces, as we are required to do in areas where there's a concurrent jurisdiction. For example, the research on the impact of socioeconomic impact of illegal gambling and what NGB's role would be specifically to curb online gambling. In conclusion, basically, we thrive to continue, that's on slide 27, we thrive to continue maintaining a balance of the socioeconomic impact of gambling versus growth in gambling industry through the effective compliance monitoring of PLAs, and that for us remains a priority. As I indicated, we're looking closely at how the limited payout machine industry is doing and these economic impact studies that we have to do, and need to table that advice to the minister for him to resolve whether then he increases the allocation into phase two of the limited pellet machine. In the casino industry, in terms of regulations published by the minister, repeat that. Are you asking the minister to review the limited payout? Okay. We will be asking him to consider whether it is in the interest of government then to consider increasing the limited payout machine national distribution from phase one into phase two. Phase one basically indicated that when the provinces reach their national allocation, a socio-economic impact study should be conducted. And in terms of regulations, it's NGB's responsibility to undertake that research and advise the minister accordingly for him to consider whether then a particular province can further roll out. And then I was going on to indicate that in the casino industry, we also faced with the same situation. In terms of the regulations, the minister had given a national allocation of 40 casinos, and at this point in time, you have 38 casinos that have been licensed countrywide. So, yes, again, this is advice that should be coming in the new financial year. And, yeah, what we're basically saying is the responsibility to maintain the balance between revenue and socioeconomic impact of gambling as we roll out further in the industry. And then we continue to monitor market share and market conduct. And that's basically our report on gross gambling revenue. And then we also have taken measures to ensure we've implemented cost containment measures as required by Treasury, and this is with regards to travel. So, Chairperson, just briefly, that's the end of our presentation.
Thank you very much, Ms. Congo. Really appreciate that overview. Now, there's one thing, though, that I didn't hear come up. It's about gambling. Where does horse racing gambling feature? Please?
With regards to horse racing, Chairperson, it's on slide... I can give you to slide 4. It falls under the betting sector because what we regulate is actually the bets that are taken on the horse racing event. So that's if horse racing falls under.
Now, thank you very much. It was just that that's all I remember, you know, like one parting reference, as it were, just a shot at it. And you know yourself that that's coming up again and again, and I would hope that we had heard a little bit more about the horse gambling and horse racing and the various issues coming up there. But be that as it may, thank you very much, and may this is the opportunity for members to comment, raise any questions. We're going to give you 3 minutes each again, starting with the Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to refer to slide 10. I just want to know, it says there on the fourth or fifth bullet point that 9.9% of gamblers may be regarded as problem gamblers. This is down from 20.2%. And I'd just like to know what happened to this 10.3% that could be problem gamblers. I've also got a big problem with just the whole slide, because it's very positive. It talks about that we don't have problem gamblers, they're decreasing, it's decreasing. Where did these figures come from? And what happened to these potential problem gamblers? Did they just disengage with gambling completely? I mean, what happened to these people? It's quite a huge drop, some of these figures. And I'm a bit skeptical about these figures. That's what I'd just like to say. So I just want some justification of these figures, please. Thank you.
Honourable Williams, Honourable Hill Lewis.
No, I must say, my question's on slide 10 as well. That slide doesn't really strike me as credible, and I think it may help if you could give us the actual research report so we can see the raw data and the reasons for these conclusions. I mean, there's got to be some major development if illegal gambling has dropped from 41% to 17%. There's got to be something big that's happened to explain that that huge drop. And as Mr. Williams has pointed out, the other numbers also look look like there may be something wrong with the raw data. So I would like to see the full report, if I may, to see the sample sizes and the margin of error and that kind of thing. Then the second thing is the LPMs in phase one. You talk about the prevalence of the provincial roll-ups in the LPMs and what percentage in each province have been rolled out. And you talk about the total number being 50,000. Is that just in phase one, or is that total across all the phases? And if so, what is the total for phase one that across the provinces and in each province?
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I'm not surprised that KZN continues to either lead or be close to leading the charge in terms of LPM and bingo machines. My thoughts and concerns about what the province is doing with that respect is well recorded within this committee. But I think that it would be very helpful to know at which point you will be engaging the Minister on the social impact assessment, particularly for KZN, because that's going to be one of the first provinces that's going to require it. And also the credibility of such a process. I mean, you yourself will know that the KZN Gambling Board, the licensing authority, are problematic to say the least. And in fact, most licensing authorities in South Africa, or at least in each province, you know, border on acting into law on their own. They seem to be out of step with national legislation. They seem to ignore recommendations that come from the Minister with respect to moratoriums placed on bingo machines. These bingo halls are popping up continuously still, and the licenses continue to be awarded. We had a discussion around the need to consolidate what the NGB's role is actually on a national basis with respect to provinces and what they can do in terms of national gambling boards. But I just want to know what more sort of vigorous measures you will be taking to ensure that the provincial licensing authorities comply with your request. I know that you've highlighted on page your risk assessment, where you say that there are
page.
I don't know what page it is, but it's in the. But it's the lack of cooperation by the PLAs, lack of participation in the fora, lack of response when efforts are sought for consolidation purposes, and lack of coherence on policy positions. I mean, that is a very big indictment on the PLAs if they continue to do so. And so, Chair, I want to implore this committee that we need to look at that problem, because they continue to be out of step with national legislation, in my opinion. I just want to continue to find out how things are going with respect to the electronic monitoring system, that tender. It's one of my pet peeves that I keep on about, because it's the one opportunity to self-fund yourself. So I want to test as soon as possible. Just where you are with respect to that process. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Williams, follow up quickly.
Yeah, sorry about that. It's just on slide 13. It says there that only 1.5% of South African population are at high risk, and I'm a bit confused about that paragraph, because it goes on to say that slide 13, the paragraph, the second paragraph there in the writing, you know, the written one. It also says compared to 9.9% of South African gamblers who are at high risk as well. So I'm a bit concerned. I'm also a bit concerned. You say only 1.5% of South African population are at high risk. 1.5% of South African population is approximately 780,000 people. So I mean, to say only 780,000 people are at high risk for gambling, I mean, you know, so I'm just, because your whole report talks to how low the percentage of problem gamblers are, when in actual fact the numbers are quite high, and it's a bit misleading, your report. Thank you.
Williams, Honourable Kalako?
Just one question of clarity. On the same slide, you have mentioned all the legal ones. What are these legal gambling? Is online gambling part of these illegal gamblers or gambling? If you can just explain or give us an examples of what are these illegal ones.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the, thank you, Honourable Kalako. I see on page 13, that was the, what the page I think Honourable Kalako was referring to. I see horse racing and sport. Now, I have a bit mind boggled here about all the zeros there. What does that mean? Right. There are a number of questions and a couple of clarifications. Over to you, Ms. Kongwa.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Just to deal with the question holistically regarding the research, I'll just read an excerpt from the report and we'll make it available. Once we make it available, it'll be very clear what informs the figures and the trends. But just in summary, is that the interviews were conducted amongst a nationally representative sample of adult South Africans aged from 15 years and older, and that a total sample of 3,598 interviews, which included all population groups, provinces, community sizes ranging from metropolitan to rural areas. They then go on to indicate that this was then weighted to represent the entire adult South African population. And then they indicate here also that a margin of error of 1.63% is applicable. They then say the results were then filtered to reflect the findings for adults aged 18 and older based on 3,551 interviews. So that's basically what the researchers did. So it doesn't represent the whole South African population. Indeed, we agree the numbers are definitely higher, but as I indicated as I was presenting to say, it's basically just based on sampling, and it's not a fully fledged countrywide research. It's just based on sampling and interviews that are conducted. So that's where the figures come from. And then the second question indeed was, can you get a copy of the research report? We'll provide it through the chairperson's office. And then as to when we'll engage the Minister for the KwaZulu-Natal socio-economic impact study, we met with the CEO for the KZN Gambling Board. As I indicated, they put in the request. We would have to follow, first of all, identify funding, and then follow a procurement process to appoint a service provider who has to conduct this particular research. And then the results we then table with the minister, and I indicated that we, considering where we are at the end of the year, which is quarter three, we definitely have to plan, and we're looking at conducting these socio-economic impact studies in the financial year 16-17, because it's something that we did not budget for. We've been monitoring the trends, and then we also had a meeting with KwaZulu-Natal Betting Board, and they basically gave us assurance that upon a further rollout, indeed, it will be urgent to conduct this study. So that's basically where we are. Regarding measures that we can take for non-compliance. It is embedded in the National Gambling Act. We do inspections and evaluations, and as I was saying, that previously National Gambling Board had not done these on-site visits. We had what one would call basically a self-evaluation, where NGV would send a questionnaire and the province would self-evaluate itself, then we keep the results. But we adopted more an audit approach where we physically go there and we inspect physical records just to check compliance. So we are, it's an area of improvement, and we are ensuring that there's compliance with the National Gambling Act. In terms of Act also, then, where we have challenges, it's incumbent on us then to report these matters to the National Policy Council. That is the minister's meeting with all the provincial MECs. So that is an area from your cooperative governance perspective and intergovernmental relations perspective. We will have to talk about these issues and report these issues to the council meeting, and then a decision is taken with the hope to resolve the matter. So those are the measures that are in place. And often the matters that are tabled at the policy council meeting then will receive the requisite attention and be dealt with. Regarding the NSEM's tender, we engage the DTI VASA from the within the two months from our last meeting here. We did, as we reported in the previous meeting, put together adjudication committees. We did get a final report from the DTI that there are certain individuals who would not be able to avail themselves. So what we've resolved to do is we've identified funding from savings from our budget, and we'll have to appoint a service provider to manage the procurement process. There are very few officials within the NGB and who are trying to ensure they attend to the deliverables in terms of the annual performance plan. It will be a big procurement process. So the minister also has endorsed or supported the appointment of an external service provider to manage this process, and he's given us his support in writing. So that's basically where we are. And then slide 13, the last question was basically whether these whether these are legal gambling modes. We have definitely, it's a combination of the gambling activities, and this is emanating from the research, but definitely National Lottery, as you know, is legally licensed. And then the National Gambling Board then regulates, as licensed by the Provincial Gambling Board, it will be your casinos, betting on horse racing and sport. Ordinarily, it's referred to differently at times. You know, the service provider will indicate racing and sport, but it's actually what we regulate are the bets taken on the sport. So that's the other legal mode, and then bingo limited payout machines. So it's basically four modes at this point in time, and then lottery is, as you know, it falls under gambling, however, managed then by the National Lotteries Commission. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Thank you very much, Ms. Congwa, and also thank you to yourself, the CFO, Ms. Makadus. Thank you. Now, we will, I'm not sure of the state of play, but you can, through the Parliamentary Liaison Officer of DTI, Ms. Naidu, make those the research, the studies available to us. Thank you. May I just remind Ms. Naidu, we are still awaiting the company's book. I would hope we would have that Thursday or so. Thank you. Yes.
Chairperson, we just forgot to mention that we brought through the annual report on gambling sector performance. We didn't include it with the annual report because the auditor figures only get finalized in July, and we just recently printed it, so it's for your information reference going forward.
Yes. Thank you. Members, have we all got this copy? Thank you very much. No, thank you very much, and I take it everything's on track, and that little shredders doing only the right stuff. Thanks. If we can then, members, we are more or less on track. We're going to be getting the briefing on the National Empowerment Funds, the second quarter, financial and non-financial performance. We really want to welcome the Chief Executive Officer, Ms. Fasiwe Mketwa. Thank you very much. Is that one of the dresses that one of the entities are making? Because it looks very colourful. Thank you. And then also Ms. Flingiwe Makatini. Right. Divisional Executive, Venture Capital and Corporate Finance. We also have Mr. Setlakalana Malepo. Mr. Malepo. Divisional Executive, Small and Medium Enterprises and Rural Development, and the chairperson is also with us this morning, Mr. Rakesh Garach. Just seeing he seems to be the only male member here this morning who's supporting this November, you know, the prostate cancer thing, I think it is, and you grow moustaches. Yeah, but I see you seem to burn a record time. Yeah, that is something. Some people went bald 1 year for something. Well, thank God you're not asked to do that all the time. All right, I should also just mention that we had organized to be in the old assembly chamber. That did not happen, and we apologize to you, CEO, but it was beyond our control. But we do have displays there. Now, it is important for members to go down after this meeting and go and have a look. What is there? What is it that they're doing? And I think the other point that is made here is that is on this sheet of paper. I don't know how many of you have got it. Over there on the desk or table. All right. But let me leave that because we're going to hand over now. We welcomed you, Ms. Mketwa. Please go ahead. Thank you, and thank you for coming.
Honorable Chairperson, Ms. John Fass, and honorable members of the Portfolio Committee and the colleagues from the GDI, thank you for this opportunity to present to you the second quarter performance report of the National Empowerment.
Let's not compete. Let's hear everyone. We've heard other presenters. Let's focus. Thank you.
So as honourable members are aware, the exhibition pavilion that the chairperson was referring to earlier is in the foyer outside this chamber and is hosting a sample of the NEEF investee family. These are entrepreneurs, Madam Chair, from across different sectors of the South African economy, representing businesses that are owned by black women and men from across the length and breadth of our country. They have brought with them the actual products of their trade as a practical testimony that indeed the quest for an inclusive economy is well on call. So we just wanted to give the honorable members the opportunity to engage some of our investee companies as well. So they manufacture cement, building panels, packaging, roof trusses, components for trains, tools for industry and defense sector, condoms, emergency lights for ambulances and police vehicles, and much more. Each of these businesses have been funded by the National Empowerment Fund. The chairperson has already introduced our delegation. So, honorable members, if I can go to slide number 3. Our presentation comprises a total of 45 content slides. Some of them will be for information purposes only, and the rest are supporting data for additional information. Chairperson, we hope there will be sufficient time to provide an appreciation of performance from inception to date, as well as specific updates relating to quarter two. Sometimes it's very difficult in our environment to capture our performance only on a quarter-by-quarter basis, and I will explain that later. Equally important will be reflections on the recapitalization of the NEF, a matter that has continued to weigh heavily on our minds. The Portfolio Committee is aware that the AF is the only DFI in South Africa that has the exclusive mandate to grow and implement broad-based economic empowerment. This is so because, as a direct consequence of apartheid colonialism, Black people still own 3% direct equity in the national economy if we use the JSE as a proxy. We had lengthy and very robust discussions with the JSE on this matter because they have a different number. However, we have all agreed to disagree that we are here to measure the specific components of the scorecard using the JSE as a proxy, whereas the JSE, we've been informed by the people we're talking to that they actually have a different mandate. So just to give the committee an example, so when they measure Black ownership on the JSE, they have a lot of exclusions. One of those exclusions, they will actually take foreign ownership, so they will strip it out, and then they measure, so if let's say 40% of the JSE in South Africa is owned by foreign companies and asset management companies, they will strip that out and only measure is based on the 60% only. Whereas we want to go there and measure how much it actually accrued to the level of Black equity interest that has accrued to Black hands. So just to refresh the committee's memory, the NEF implement the Code of Good Practice of Broad-Based Economic Empowerment is outlined in the NEF Act. In this regard, the NEF uses a sector-targeted approach in developing its portfolio, and these sectors include renewable energy, tourism, mineral beneficiation, agro-processing, BPOs, and infrastructural projects. I will talk about some of these projects later on in my presentation. In doing so, the NEF specifically seeks to support the initiatives of the DTI, including ITEP, and more broadly, the National Development Plan, by championing and funding the advancement of emerging entrepreneurs into becoming Black industrialists. The government priorities that we seek to support include acceleration of economic growth and transformation and creating decent jobs. So when we look at our investments, we'll be looking for these specific issues and criteria. We look at infrastructure and rural development. We also look at skills transfer and human resource development, as well as looking at building developmental aid and improved public service. So while we place a lot of importance on commercial viability when we look at our transactions, our mandate also focuses on softer measures in assessing applications for funding, and these include development indicators, such as once we have done the commercial viability of the project, we also want to see, to look at the participation by Black women, we look at community involvement, we look at Black ownership, and we also look at how many jobs are going to be created through our investment and the geographic location of the business. So these measures form part of the developmental ethos which the NEF has adopted as the underlying theme of its funding strategy, and together constitute a methodology that we refer to as the empowerment dividend. So we look for the financial dividend, but at the same time we want to achieve the empowerment dividend. From operational inception in 2004 to date, the NEF has approved 688 transactions worth more than 6.6 billion for Black empowered businesses across the country. Over 4.6 billion of this is capital that has gone directly into the economy. We are certain that honorable members of the Portfolio Committee share our sense of fulfillment that for 10 years running, the NES has secured unqualified external audit opinions. And that to date, through its funding milestone, the NES has supported in excess of 82,000 jobs countrywide. And in terms of the work that we are doing in the Black industrialization area, we can point to 20 strategic and industrial projects that are worth 27 billion, with the potential to support a further 80,000 jobs. So you see that out of the 80,000 jobs that we are referring to here, some of the jobs have already been created. So, for instance, if you look at the investment we made in Mabele Fuels, So if we get all the necessary approvals, we've been informed that the Minister of Energy has already signed off on some of those approvals, National Treasury. So when we go ahead on this one, so this is a 2.6 billion rand transaction. We invested a little bit of our money, and then we went to the private sector to raise the additional funding. There, Madam Chair, and the production is going to be located in Bloemfontein. Yes. Waterville. Here we'll be creating about 15,000 jobs. So there will be about 10,000 direct jobs. So I'd like to remind the committee members, honourable members, about the Affordable Share Scheme, which remains one of the most seminal public share offers in our country, having brought over 12 million MDN shares into the hands of 87,000 black investors. So I have to say that most of the investors who bought our Songe shares are still in the money because a lot of them have not disposed of their shares. Yes. So we'd like to do more of these offers, Madam Chair. So whenever there is an opportunity from the state to sell a little bit of their equity or their non-core assets, would like to come up with similar retail offers which could be used to empower our citizens. Yes. And then our investor education campaign has reached over 24,000 black South Africans in the villages and townships. Today they know something meaningful about how to save and invest. They know something about personal financial discipline. They also know something about how to invest in the equities markets and the risks that are associated with owning shares. Today, the NEF Entrepreneurship Training and Incubation Program has provided business loans to more than 2,500 participants who attended about 105 seminars countrywide. And then our regional office network continues to shoulder the very high demand for funding from among black entrepreneurs, with 42% of the number of approved transactions emanating from regional offices and our pre-investment departments. So we're pleased to also report that we'll be opening the last office in the Northern Cape, which will commence with its operations in quarter four. And because our mentorship program is succeeding in stabilizing our investees, over 1.5 billion has been collected in repayments. So, Madam Chair, here we want to emphasize that our enterprises do pay back when we have given them our So having received the annual report, honourable members are aware of the performance highlights of the previous financial year. To select a few of these briefly, last year, the NEF approved 94 deals worth 895 million against a target of 96 deals worth 718 million. Last year alone, our funding activities supported over 33,000 job opportunities, of which 32,000 were new jobs. And in terms of supporting black women entrepreneurs, 47% of commitments made in the financial year were towards businesses partially or wholly owned by black women against the target of 45%. And through our rural and community trust investments, effective women shareholding in rural areas is currently sitting at 60%. In terms of collections, over 1.5 billion was collected cumulatively from loans dispersed across the country in black-owned and managed businesses across virtually all the sectors of the economy. And in terms of growing the number of sustainable black industrialists, the chairperson, the Honorable Jumfa, witnessed the launch of the Tadeflay Hospital in Strand earlier this year. The launch was also attended by the MEC for Health, and we're very grateful for that. If I may just take the members on what this hospital does, it specializes in cardiology. It is owned by black doctors and surgeons under the Busamed Group, which has been granted 4 hospital licenses across the country. So that we are aware, Madam Chairperson, that government has decided not to invest in private hospitals, but we had already made this investment.
I'm struggling to hear myself, please, notwithstanding that the CEO is sitting next to me. you're welcome to discuss whatever it is you want to, but perhaps you could just leave the room to do that.
But what is also pleasing about this investment, Madam Chairman, is that almost 50% of our funding, so this is the beauty of some of these venture capital projects that we have invested in. You invest your initial funding. When it reaches financial close, you can decide to exit, but by that time you have already leveraged additional funding from other funders into the project. So almost 50% of our funding has already been repaid. And we are hoping to get the next tranche in the next coming months. The total transaction size here was 1.6 billion. We did not invest 1.6 billion. We facilitated the investments by the crowding in of other investors to our investment. So during this period, Madam Chair, we have progressed an additional 4 industrial projects to the pilot financial close commercialization stages in the portfolio. The first is Inaco Medical, which progressed from bankable feasibility to financial close following a total injection of 177 million into a business that will be the only manufacturer of auto disposable syringes and needles in the SADC region. And honorable members, I ought to give you a glimpse into how we at the NES approach the quest to facilitate the emergence of black industrialists. Together with other partners, the NES is at the forefront of efforts to manufacture hypodermic disposable syringes and needles in partnership with a company known as Inaco Medical. The NES has approved a total investment of 75 million, which has progressed now to bankable feasibility. So just for the members to know the rationale for investing in this project, there's currently no local manufacturing of any type of syringes in South Africa or indeed across Southern Africa or in the continent for that matter. The market size within the SADC region is 1.1 billion syringes and 911 million needles. So we've been importing syringes in South Africa, SADC and the continent from Europe and other countries in Asia. So the proposed plant capacity is 200 million normal syringes and 30 million safety or retractable syringes and 200 million needles. So detailed engineering designs are complete and offtake agreements, so we have actually reached the financial close on this one. So what kind of intervention do we need from the committee members and the DDI? I think for an investment of this nature, we would need the designation of syringes and needles so that the Department of Health can set aside a certain percentage of their syringe acquisition for local manufactured syringes. We believe, Madam Chair, that this is the best way to go. We have to apply a little bit of protectionism, to some of the
designation.
Yes, yes. So this will enhance the ability of the project to secure the actual implementation going forward. We've done everything, all our studies, and also the inputs they go into the manufacturing of syringes comes from specially a product called polypropylene. So we have all the competitive and comparative advantages that we need. The second is a tire energy extraction where the NEF has invested 57 million into the establishment of a tire recycling plant to be located in the Koha Industrial Development Zone in Port Elizabeth. The company has been accredited by a reducer, a non-profit company as a recycler of tires, and has fully secured offtake for all their products. There's another one, KC Energy, which is based in KZN. It's a producer of industrial steam and power, whose major customer is a supplier to the tire manufacturing industry. The NEF invested about 56 million here, and we hold a 40% stake in the operation. The next one is African Silica Holdings. Is a Gauteng-based company, which the NEF invested 9.1 million in 2010 for a 49% stake. So we always take a small equity, but when we decide to exit, we offload to black-owned enterprises. The project is looking to set up a plan to beneficiate the abundant silica streams in South Africa and localize the production of silica-based products, which have significant local applications. So the applications will include household products such as detergents, fabric softeners, household cleaners, personal care products such as shampoos and deodorants. So it has a wide variety of applications. So we're hopeful that we'll also take this one to full implementation. Slide 13, Madam Chair, in relation to the need to propel entrepreneurial development, the NEF also facilitated the provision of 21 training sessions while 89 entrepreneurs were fed to incubation partners with 50 being successfully incubated. So our incubation methodology has actually worked very well for us, entrepreneurs. Last year alone, the investor education campaign reached a total of 39 villages and townships. And the current financial year began amid a troubled global economic climate. We wanted to touch on this so that you'll also understand the context within which we are reporting our results. This manifested through continued decline in Chinese economic growth affecting iron and steel manufacturing sectors in South Africa. I won't go through the whole list because the DG has already done this. So this adverse economic climate calls for heightened post-investment monitoring from the NEF perspective. We've seen more and more investee companies that are requesting the moratoria on repayments and interest paid. They're asking for reduced installments and the extension of loan tenures. So, Madam Chair, we have actually done a lot of restructuring of our financing arrangements that we have given to our investing companies. So hostile has the economic climate been that 5 of the 7 companies that we have transferred to turnaround warehouse and restructuring units are in the manufacturing and construction sectors, which are significant contributors to jobs. So this means the NEF has to intensify community and entrepreneurial training in order to support anticipated widespread retrenchments. This we will continue to do through investor education. So this now talks to the people who have been retrenched from the different sectors of the economy. So in accordance, slide 18 and 19, with its shareholder compact with the DDI, the NEF reports on the basis of key strategy objectives, and these are advancing BEE and growing black industrialists, maximizing the empowerment of its strength, optimizing non-financial support, financial efficiency, and sustainability. I won't go through each and every one of them, so this was just for information purposes only, because I've already covered the ones for the years that they are here. So I wanted to go to slide number 24 and 25, which talks to the types of market failures that we are trying to address as an organization. At the heart of the mandates of the NEF is the resolve to address and mitigate the challenges and market failures that typically confront black entrepreneurs. These market failures include the lack of access to affordable finance, lack of accurate and reliable information, a lack of business planning skills, lack of access to local and international markets, quite an inadequate specific industry knowledge. I'm just highlighting them, but the NEF has actually put together quite a number of instruments that are looking at addressing some of the market failures there. But we have not covered all of them, but I just wanted the honorable members to note them. So, slide 26. Honourable members, we also made the point earlier that if we use the JSE as a proxy, black people are still excluded from the economic spectrum. That is why the NEF does not limit its funding only to SMEs, but indeed seeks to see black people also owning major corporations and also graduating into becoming global and black industrialists. So in the view of the NEF, therefore, black business does not equate to small business because that would perpetuate an apartheid construct according to which black people must remain on the periphery as owners of very small and micro enterprises. For this reason, the NEF funds across the economic spectrum will start with the very, very small. We also go to medium funds and end up financing some of those companies that will end up becoming global players. So that is why the NEF was amongst the first to welcome last week's announcement that Cabinet had approved the Black Industries Policy. We believe this important step will become the catalyst in unlocking capital and partnerships from across the public and private sector to enable more and more black entrepreneurs to become major players in the economy. So when this happens, they will find that our strategic projects fund at the NEF is a tried and tested harbinger in seeking to increase the number of black people in early stage projects. And our experience in investing in early stage is that whilst we might actually think that, you know, the private sector is not willing to invest in some of these things, I think, Madam Chair, there has been a lack of, you know, projects that you can take to bankable feasibility, which is why the private sector has also not been willing to invest. But once these projects have been packaged and conceptualized, we've actually seen a very good appetite coming from our private sector investors, because in all of them, almost all of them, we have co-invested with the commercial banks. Sometimes they provide debt, and the DFI would also come in and give us a little bit of equity. So through this fund, the NEF has made important steps in seeking competitive opportunity for the South African economy and the inclusion of black participation in opportunities at the outset of projects as opposed to doing it during financial closure. So I want to take you through slide 29. It's self-explanatory. It's on the rationale for, you know, coming up with the strategic project fund, which we did in 2007. So slide 30, for some 7 years now, the NEF has been hard at work to help develop the industrialists. Today we can point to 20 strategic and industrial projects worth 27 billion with the potential to create 80,000 jobs. I won't go through that slide here. Slide 31, so I just wanted to show you the typical project development stages, what it covers. So basically, we spend a lot of time looking at the scoping and concept. And this is the initial stage of project development used to generate, refine, and shortlist ideas for further development. And then we'll take the project, pre-feasibility study. We're talking about the hospital. It took us about 3 years to develop the hospital to where it is today. If I talk about Mandela, it's taken us about 4 years to move it from where it was to the financial close. So these are just the different stages of project development. Stage 4 is the fundraising stage, which is reached when project execution capital is raised from equity investors, both local and international, and then it goes to financial close and project implementation. Slide 32, this is the portfolio pipeline of the NES strategic industrial projects. I have already mentioned that we have 20 investments that are sitting in this pipeline. So if our target, the target that was announced by the DTI is 100, what it says is that we already have the 20 in our pipeline. So which means with more resources we can achieve more. Slide 33, it just talks about this lack of venture capital capability in South Africa. So we're saying this is what we're doing at NEF. If we can get more resources, we'll be able to do more. Honorable members, under slide 34 and 35, we believe the efficacy and value of the NEF was underlined yet again when President Zuma stated in last year's State of the Nation address that all DFIs, including the NEF, would continue to provide finance to viable black-owned businesses. This important announcement was received with great excitement by the NEF and black entrepreneurs at large, because it meant their pleas had been heard and that their quest was indeed legitimate. So let me take you through the journey of the NEF recapitalization. As honorable members are aware, the journey of the NEF recap has been long. It begins in 2004 when government undertook here at Parliament to fund the NEF to the tune of 10 billion over the next 5 years. Between 2004 and 2010, the NEF was capitalized to the tune of 2.4 billion. So that was the only portion we got from the 10 billion, all of which was fully dispersed by 2010. Since then, the NEA has been self-financed with proceeds from dividend and interest from its investments and proceeds from the sale in 2007 through our Aswang share scheme of a portion of the AF holding in MTA Group. During this period, operating expenses were supported through the UTI transfers of 322 million over a five-year period up to 2010. Over the years, the NEF applications for recapitalization have not been successful. So I won't go through all of this because the members... Yes. I was just reminding the members. So we're seeing the dangers of not recapitalizing the NEF, that in the view of many, there are clear dangers. So the first one is that it has the potential to weaken public trust in government and parliament's commitment to broad-based black economic empowerment. You actually hear it in the boardrooms, Madam Chair, that people are now doubting our yes. The delay can also result in a funding crisis for black entrepreneurs who have very few options, and only us, and we call ourselves a funder with a soul, because sometimes you can just come with the idea and would assist you to turn that idea into bankable projects. It has also led to staff attrition and institutional memory leakage because people are saying, what if we don't get the recapitalization? It also threatens the potential collapse and closure of a VIP. We believe that we are a high-performing organization. You saw our results. It undermines the historical obligation and importance of transforming the economy, and it emboldens the private sector's disregard for the transformation imperative. So, Madam Chair, as an institution that gives hope to others, we can never lose hope ourselves. This is so because more and more black people are turning to entrepreneurship, and given the known market failures which they face, it is only an institution like the NEF that remains their primary hope. It is
just hold on that slide, May there, at slide 37 that we're on as we talk. This morning, members, when I opened, I referred to the Mindy, which is one of the more, you know, the most courageous examples of soldiers dying for what they believe in. And also we indicated that the sacrifices that people make in the contribution to social justice, the economy, and the political transformation over the years have done, been done. And I'd like people to stand for just a minute. Thank you. I suppose it's quite symbolic that you are in the middle of your presentation, CEO, as I know you were awarded the Legion d'honneur with the fleur de lis, etc. Right, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we acknowledge and value the continued support from the portfolio committee and the DCI to date. And our discussions and engagements will also continue with the following institutions, the IDC, the Jobs Fund, the UIF, and the PIC and others. So we've been engaging on all of those entities, and there has been a lot of interest, Madam Chair, from them. Slide 38. To give the Portfolio Committee an update, since July 2014, the NEF has been in discussion with the IDC in a process supported by both the DCI and Economic Development. The objective was to find sustainable and long-term recapitalization for the NEF. The engagement was also motivated by the President's assertion that the DFI prepared to coordinate their investment programs. In kind, the process assessed various structural options to coordinate and strengthen the investment programs of the two DFIs. The option recommended by both the NEF and the DGI is the one where the NEF becomes an arm's-length subsidiary of the IEC. So what does that mean here? What this means is that the NEF assets and business will be transferred to a company which is a subsidiary of the IEC. The NEF will have a separate board management and support structures. This option has various advantages, including the fact that the NEF continues as an independent entity focusing on BEE and has an opportunity of increasing developmental impact as a result of recapitalization from IEC. So further, the board provides guidance to NEF on direction, and IEC focuses on its mandate of industrial development. The DTI is custodian of broad-based BEE legislation and policy in the country, continues to maintain oversight over NEF as implementation agent of such policies. And by definition, it would mean that the NEF would still be accountable to the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee in Parliament. And the mandate of the NEF would continue as is, undiluted. So this is our submission to the DTI and economic development, and I have to say that they've been very supportive. So slide 41, it just shows our unencumbered cash position as currently speak, which stands at about 1.32 billion. That is the actual cash to date. And the NEF has 683 million, which is our unencumbered cash position. So that's what we have in the bank account. And assuming that all settlements in the pipeline materialize, the NEF projects to fully fund the 2015-2016 activities. So in order to discharge our 2016-2017 strategy, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, 1 billion in new money would be required as a cash injection. So that is beyond March next year. 1 billion. Just to
no, 1 billion.
To take us forward. And slide 43, those are our efficiency ratios. Mm-hmm. So the NEF efficiency cost to income ratios compare favorably, Madam Chair, with 4 DFIs and 1 target fund over a 3-year period shown. The positive decline in the case of the NEF was mainly driven by self-imposed funding and headcount moratorium.
We've got about 5 minutes for this to be concluded before we engage.
Okay. The other slides are for information purposes only. And then I can conclude with the slide, Madam Chair, because if you look at all these other slides, they're just showing the graphical depiction of all the things I was talking about. So we hope that these reflections have provided useful context in order to explain why the NEF invests considerable effort, time, and intellectual capital in providing innovative financial and non-financial support to its target market. That is why the funder with his own processes and systems have to be compassionate and flexible, because the constraints facing our target market are historical, unique, and formidable. Thank you, Honourable Members and Madam Chair.
Thank you, CEO Mtetwa. Thank you very much. We now have the opportunity to engage, and I'm going to recognize the first hand that was up here, Honourable Hill Lewis, followed by Honourable Williams, followed by Honourable McPherson. Thank you. 3 minutes again.
Thank you. It's a very detailed and comprehensive presentation. I thank you for that. We should have had 3 hours to deal with it, but we have to compress that now. So I will just touch on a few things. I'd love to discuss it in more detail with you at some other time. Firstly, do I understand you correctly that the actual job created is 3,200? The 83,000 refers to extended kind of indirect jobs, but the cumulative actual jobs is 3,200, if I understand you correctly. Then if you could brief us more on the Boeterville project. You said 10,000 direct jobs. That sounds like an enormous, enormous project. That would be triple your cumulative previous performance. I'd like to know more about that and what it is. Then just on the page that you've given us, why are some of these companies in green? Are those the companies that are working out, or some of them are in white and then some of them are in green? I just wanted to, that might be just a basic question. Then on your return on investments, this is that your return on investment is 9.1%, which is brilliant. Sorry. So this says that your return on investment is 9.1%. What I want to understand is that before your impairments, or is that including all of your impairments? If it is return on investment of total capital employed, 9.1% is excellent, and you should be able to leverage a lot more private sector money at that kind of return. So I'd like to just delve a little bit more into what your return on investment figures are. And then I want to end on your figures about black ownership on the JSE and make myself very clear that you know, obviously I completely support the mandate of the NEF, but the thing that is still easy to misinterpret in this slide is that what you are suggesting is that 97% of the JSE is owned by white people, which is not true. And so it doesn't contribute to kind of nation building in that sense, because and this has come up many times in debates in Parliament, and it's been often used as evidence that 97% of the economy is still owned by white people, when in fact 83% of the JSE is owned by foreign companies and by investment funds, pension funds essentially. So only 17% of the JSE is actually owned directly by investors, and of that 17%, 3% are black direct investors. So I think that the full context needs to be given. If you're going to use the 3% figure and not the JSE figure, I understand your reasoning. I'm happy to accept that reasoning. But then you must please give the full context. Because the way that you presented it here is not the full context at all, and actually contributes to willful misinterpretation. Not by you, but by others. On the second bullet, you've set this target of 25% black control. Again, only 17% of the whole JSE is owned by individuals. So to achieve 25%, you'd have to squeeze out like pension funds and foreign investors. So I'm not sure that 25% is a realistic target, unless you are talking about 25% of the 17% that is privately owned, in which case, again, you must please give the full context. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Lewis, Honourable William.
Thank you, Chairperson. Now, I'm also going to talk about the 3% story. I just want to know, with regard to the white people that actually own the shares on the stock exchange, or let me put it this way, with regard to the white-owned economy in South Africa, what is their attitude towards the process of transformation? Have you picked up any challenges with regard to that? And that's what I want to know. I want to know, is the process of transforming our economy being embraced by all sectors of our economy, or just by a certain sector? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable McPherson.
Sorry. Thanks, Chair. It's on record in this committee, and certainly in public, about my very strong support of what the NEF should be doing. To the extent that I had brought the idea of a national venture capital fund to be located within the NEF, which this committee agreed with. What I'm not in support of is the continued ballooning of salaries that continue within the NEF. At a total of 17 million rand, which includes yourself and Ms. Mdetwa's salary of 5.7 million rand, which is a half a million rand increase on last year. And when one juxtaposes that against the 2,000 job opportunities that have been created this year,
My question simply to you, ma'am, is how do we continue, or how do you continue to justify salaries that are dispersed in your organization and yours more particularly? Because, DG, I'd like to rope you in here now, and I hope you'll be given opportunity to answer the question. With such salaries that are being paid in an entity that, not by its own fault, is unable to fulfill its own mandate due to the fiscal constraints that have existed with it, certainly for the last 3 years, and most probably for the next few foreseeable years, you know, how do we keep pushing this entity forward, keep continuing with the, quite frankly, enormous salaries that exist within that entity, when it is unable to fulfill its job, not because of its own making, but because of external problems? Do we still need, or can we still afford to continue with the NEF if we cannot financially support it? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think the Honourable Colonel had his hand up. No. All right. Then that's everyone has spoken and made their comments. And we're going to turn over to yourself, CEO. We will give the DG an opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will respond to the question that was raised by Honourable Hill Lewis on the number of jobs, and then I will the Chair will take the ROI question. Can you provide more details on Mabele fuel? So basically, the 83,000 jobs, that's cumulative, so that's what has been created over the last 10 years. The 80,000 jobs, the additional 80,000 jobs is what will come from the strategic project funds only. So that's an additional 80,000. And as I said, some of these jobs have already been created. I spoke about KC Energy, I spoke about the hospital. So they will be coming, you know, slowly. It's not like we'll achieve the full 80,000 in 1 year. And then the 3,000 is what has been created. So if I remember, I started talking about the very tight market conditions that we are finding ourselves in. And then I was saying in Mabele Fuels alone, if we get all the approvals, they were well positioned to create about 15,000 jobs. That's the biofuels investment that we made in Bloemfontein, with partners that are coming from all over the country. Some of them are here in Cape Town, but what is good, the investment is going to be going to one of the most economically depressed areas of the country. And then I'll ask my colleague to just give you more details on the technical details.
Thank you, CEO, and good morning to the Honourable Members. On Mabele, the reason we are able to generate so many jobs is that one of the requirements of the Department of Energy is that the raw material that you use must be local. So you can't import, for example, our plant is going to use sorghum, so we can't import the sorghum. So we have to develop emerging farmers to actually grow the sorghum, and there's the multiplier effects of and actually those farmers are also co-shareholders in the project. There are some shares that are being warehoused for them.
Good news. Thank you. Thank you, Sophia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the total investment is 2.6 billion. So it talks about the leveraging effect of our investment, Madam Chair, that we invest a little bit in find other, you know, private investors to come in, co-invest with us. And then on the JSE question, Honourable Member Hill Lewis, so you're saying the suggestion here is that 97% of the JSE equity is owned by white South Africans. No, that's not what we're saying. So it goes back to...
I know that's not what you say.
No, just a minute. We will give you an opportunity.
All right. No,
continue.
Yeah.
So essentially, it goes back to the BEE policies of the country, you know, that were approved by this very same house in 2001, 2002. So as part of that process, the portfolio committee had agreed in principle that we should set targets of about 25.1% for all the key sectors of the economy. So we're saying 25.1% of the economy should be in black hands by 2014. So that was the target. So they were also using the JSE as a proxy then. So what we are calculating, we're saying, so in terms of those policies that were approved and passed by Parliament in 2001-2002, how much of the 25% has accrued or has vested in black hands? So that's our measurement. So we didn't say, they didn't say at the time that, okay, now that 40% is owned by, you know, your foreign or international asset management companies and fund managers, will only look at 60%. So the 25% was based on the 100%. So that's how we're calculating it. So we're like following, you know, the policy as it was approved, we're following it to T.
I can just have a two finger on that, because I think the CEO misunderstood my point.
No, I didn't. No, but you see now what happens? Because I didn't recognize.
Okay, fine, I'll have a follow-up.
You know, we're going to have just a dialogue, but we don't want to go that way.
So what you are saying is, yes, 40% is owned by foreigners, the 60% is owned by South Africans, and 17% is owned by individuals. So in that mix, how much is owned by black South Africans? That's how we have done our calculation. And then Honorable Williams was talking about the attitude towards you know, transformation in general. It's a difficult question. It's a difficult question. So I think when we came up with the BEE policies, Honorable Member, there are certain aspects of it that we did not pay, you know, a lot of attention to. So let me give you an example. So from the financing side of things, we'll just be happy and celebrate when these transactions were concluded. So you read about them in the media, you know, so and so has bought 10% equity stake here. But we never looked at the financing arrangements that were put in place, you know, to actually facilitate those transactions. So a lot of them are underwater. So I don't know whether it was intentional or something else has happened, because a lot of them, you know, just so even though, because people are thinking, so if you see only 3%, what about the billions that were announced? None of that equity has really translated to black hands. And then I will hand over to the chair on the ROI and the sorry.
Thank you, CEO. Thank you, Madam Chair. Honorable Hillou, to answer your question on the ROI, the calculation of 9.1% is before impairments. And in terms of using that to leverage private sector funding, what certainly you've heard from the CEO and the executives, that our strategy is to crowd in. We prefer not to be the sole funder in any transaction. That is certainly part of our funding program and strategy. I also want to just answer your question in terms of why some of these in green and some as others in white. The green ones represent the ones that are based here in Cape Town. For you to contact them directly if you need to, but they are downstairs. Honorable McPherson, your question around ballooning salaries at the NF, job creation versus the salaries. We're an organization that competes with investment banking professionals in the market. We've got, in order for us to attract and retain talent, we need to compete and pay salaries that are comfortable in the Sandton Square Mile. So our salaries are market related. We have mechanisms in place around performance, not only individual performance, organizational performance, as well as incentives around that. So we're in a market that is competing for scarce resources. We've got to ensure that we attract and retain the right talent and the right level of skills. Certainly, as a board, we measure our cost-to-income ratio and we benchmark not only against other DFIs but also against the private sector. And we believe that we are competitive on that basis. In terms of our funding mix, of our staffing mix, we have 12 chartered accountants that are employed in the business, 12 individuals with master's degrees, 6 individuals who are engineers and 4 of whom hold master's degrees, 13 with honors degrees, 53 with bachelor's degrees, and 9 professionals with LLB qualifications. So that gives you some indication of the caliber of people at the NEF. Hence, we believe that to maintain this level of skill in the organization, we've got to pay competitive salaries. Does that?
Thank you, Chairperson. No, I'm not saying that's it, but thank you very much for that response. Now, what I want to just indicate to members, what this is now is, if, in your opinion, something was missed out. Thank you. Honourable McPherson.
Thanks, Chair. Also, just in your response from the DG, but with respect, my question was directed to Ms. Mteto, and the question was, how does she justify her salary of 5.7 million rand versus the 2,000 job opportunities created this year? That is the response I would like directly from the CEO.
I think Mr. Mofeo, the Honourable is out of order. Completely out of order. No, you're out of order, Chief.
No, it's not my... into dialogue.
No, it's completely out of order.
The
question is answered. He's targeting Miss Tego now. That's targeting of an individual. No, you're out of order. The question is answered. It's answered. It's not answered. You are not because it's Miss Tego, you are not satisfied she's getting that money. That's your parents. That's what you're trying to allude to. You are completely out of order.
Honorable Whip, what I want to do is... we got your point here. The point I was going to make was simply that the head of an air entity, in this case it's the NEF, may refer any question to a member of her team. That has always been the practice, always. And as I say, I had the opportunity many years ago of visiting other countries and had a look at how other committees were run. And it became apparent that it depended on the actual political dispensation in the country. So you could get a situation where committees ran as courts. And then you could get a situation where they were somewhat different, and there was a wide range of that. What we have adopted is a constructive approach to engagement. What that does mean is we may require further input, but you can put that hand down. I have seen it, Honourable McPherson, I've seen it. But we did hear a response. Your main concern would appear to be that the CEO herself did not respond. Well, she's entitled to refer questions to members of the team, and that will remain the case. If further information is required, we can request it. But that is where we are on the matter. Honourable McPherson, I would appreciate it if you would stop making side, S-I-D-E, comments. Honourable Colonels?
Chairperson, just...
Normally in an institution like this, you will have a remuneration committee that will decide certain salary scales. I think that was explained by the chairperson. And I personally think it's unfair to ask a direct question to a person about her salary for her to explain it. There's ample other ways to go through the RC of that institution, put it, and see what's their policy with regard to that. But I think that is maybe why the channel the Honourable Member should have used.
The Honourable Colonel, and I think it re-emphasises the point Whip was making, and what we did try and indicate last week. There's a need for robust engagement in oversight, but there's also a need for us to recognise that from our constitution it derives the commitment and the principle of respecting people's dignity. And we're not going to change that in this committee. So we must be robust, we must engage that in that manner. But this is a point that if we do need to pursue, we will pursue in the right manner. Thank you. Now, Honourable Hill Lewis, you had your hand up on something.
Thank you very much. Ms. Mtetwa, thanks for that reply. The only point I was making was that when referring to the 3%, it would be useful if you could also give the context of the other figures, not just verbally, but also in the documents, because I can promise you it's often misquoted and misinterpreted, even in Parliament, often, to suggest that because you say you only say 3%, the inference draw is that obviously 97% of the rest of the JSC is owned by white South Africans, when we know that that's definitely not the case. In fact, only 17% of the whole JSC is owned by individuals. And so it doesn't contribute to nation building where that misinterpretation is so often repeated. But I think you understand the point I'm making. Then to the chairperson, do you have a blended figure for your return on investment, including impairments? It would be useful to publish that. What's the overall return on investment with impairments? I'd like to get that figure. And then if we could just differentiate between direct jobs and indirect jobs. The 83,000 cumulative, is that direct or indirect or both? And what's the split? Thanks.
Right. I'm going to ask the DG to come in on a question that was put to him, I think, by the Honourable McPherson. I may be wrong. Right.
Just to deal with two issues raised by McPherson, I think firstly, as he correctly says, we've had a discussion in government about the future of our DFIs. And as you know, most of state institutions or development finance institutions in South Africa, like whether it's your PIC, your IDC, your land bank, many of them in the early stages, and many of them are 40, 50 years old, or IDC 60 years old, receive substantial government support when they were established. That is why the IDC is now I don't know what's the market capitalization, say 60, 80 billion. But as you know, in 1948, they were started given substantial resources. But it's not only South African phenomenon, it's throughout the globe. If you take KfW, if you take BNDES in Brazil, many countries start investment banks. The European Investment Bank is bigger than the World Bank because you need concessional financing for your manufacturing sector and for your developmental purposes. So what we are doing now is with the National Endowment Fund, and I must say without any fear of a contradiction, Pilisiwe, when she left the department to be seconded to run, take over the NEF, she started from an institution which had probably an investment book of less than 100 million. It is now multi-billion investment. From a moribund organization to what we can be very proud is a very, very effective institution. And as mentioned by the chair, they are all finance professionals. As you said, Pilisiwe, besides being French-speaking, we recruited her from Standard Bank and BNP Paribas, where she worked for international finance organizations and international banks. So we, as I said, just to reiterate, all our GFIs, finance professionals there, and reiterate So I take it that I made the point about the salaries in GFIs being market related. If you look at the PIC, if you look at the and then finally, is that PDCV doesn't determine our salary. So I think it would be correct for her not to answer that question. It's determined by the board that sets salaries for all our PFIs. And I said the good news to report is that the two ministers, Minister of Economic Development and Minister of Trade, have finally reached the agreement on the future arrangement for the NEF. They've agreed that the NEF will become a subsidiary of the IDC, but it will maintain its independent board and especially its independent mandate to drive black economic empowerment. By doing that, it will then have access to the balance sheet of the IDC, which will allow it then to provide concessional finance. And also most important is that the IDC has borrowing rights in terms of an institution that NEF doesn't have those rights to borrow money in the open market. So through the IDC's mandate, then we'll be able to have borrowing rights, which means we'll be able to leverage the private sector funding, EFI funding, and so on. So that was finalized about 4 weeks or 3 weeks ago, that discussion, and we are just currently engaged. The two CEOs have to drive the implementation of the subsidiary model. So I think we will have some solution to the funding arrangement.
Very welcome, I can tell you. And I must just emphasize, certainly in, I suppose it was 7 years ago, I came into the committee, that was indeed the case. NEF was in, it was really very, very sick. And no, in fact, we thought of requesting that it be closed down. It wasn't serving its purpose. But there it is. We need to engage, but we didn't have enough time for all everything that you have done. And what we would like to request before your shift or relocation, whatever we want to call it, is done, that we have the opportunity of the kind of workshop that we will be running with all of these incentive entities and those with a mandate directly related to the priorities in this direction, and that is transformation in the economy. So I want to leave it there, but there may be some questions coming to you to expand upon that have arisen in the meeting, but that applies not only to the NEF, it applies across the board. But I do want to, I'm sorry, we've run right out of time. We do need to be out of here by 10 to 12, and we've still got two items, please. That's why I said, as per normal, they will go in writing to them to respond to. That is, again, quite a regular practice that we have. And I do think that it's important for that formula to be explained to us so that we all understand that formula. All right? Thank you. So on that note, DG and the CEOs and also the administrator, Ms. Kongwai, said Caroline, perhaps she's already gone, I can't see. We would thank you for your engagement with us, but we also want to remind the members that the NEF has got a little display downstairs. I know they're anxious to close up, but I would appreciate it if we can just keep it open at least until 1 or 2, because it is a long day today in terms of the house starting only at 3. Thank you. So thank you very much. On the other side here, members, and I see you've left your newspaper here at DG. Right. The oversight visit of the committee It is the 24th to the 27th, but it begins on the 25th. I think Monday's the 24th is a Monday, and people would be traveling Monday night. But what, in the absence of staff, I've now had to take over the application myself to process it with senior management on the administration. And as I haven't done that side of this committee before, it's just taking me a wee bit of time to get used to all these quote systems and who to get to do the quotes, etc. So it is taking me a bit of time. So we are getting some assistance there from management in this regard. However, what I did want to say today is just for those who were not present at last week when I indicated this, we are going to go to Dubai. I think it is the IDZ there. We're also going, you know, that's not only the IDZ, it is also the quarantine zone for horses there. We're also going to try and see whether we can get the engagement with the port authorities in respect of the kind of goods that are not safe to bring in that the NRCS has been referring to. And the third issue, Honourable Kalaka, just remind me, because there were the three, the horses, the gambling, the Toyota. The tyres are in Newcastle, from what we were told. And unfortunately, that we just don't have that time. So we are going to go to, what do you call Lever Brothers these days? Unilever. Yeah. So, Unilevers or whatever. And then also the, there was another one. The, just help me out here, Gigi. The other one to replace the tyres. It was these taxis.
The taxis, the taxis by Toyota.
Right, manufactured there in Durban. I don't know if you know that, Honourable MacPherson, right in your stamping ground. Right. Anyway. So, and I hope you're catching them occasionally. But be that as it may, I will bring a draft in tomorrow.
I wanted to ask you about the NRCS. We discussed that last week. It's absolutely imperative that we visit the NRCS given the current state of that organization.
Well, you see, I was hoping your colleague would have briefed you on this issue because it became clear that the NRCS can be engaged down in Durban.
Is it on the program? You just didn't mention it. That's why I'm raising it.
I did. I mentioned it twice in RCS.
No?
Yes, right now.
I must be going mad. I didn't hear that at all.
No. No one's going mad, Honourable Hill.
I've lost my novels.
No. No one has. Fine. No. I'm not going down that route because I do need to just indicate three things. I haven't recognized you. So I don't know why you're speaking, and I will recognize you if you allow me to.
Thanks. You just need to note that I won't be on oversight, because that is the week that I go on medical leave now, the due medical leave date.
You did alert me privately, and I'm rather pleased that you are able to get it done, and we wish you everything of the best. We do, and it is a pity that you're unable to join us, but you'll get the report. Just on this oversight visit, I need to just refresh members' information that you may not simply change your flights without having informed the chair. And may I add, I'm not even referring to the Honourable Hill Lewis, who did brief me by email and personally, and we were able to make the changes before he took off. So, what we want, all fruitless expenditure, I'm told that this, it will be implemented and members will pay for any fruitless expenditure incurred through these private arrangements with my staff. Please don't even try to do that because I have already briefed staff on this matter. The second thing, or third thing, is we do need to have all these contact numbers. It's amazing. When it comes to this town, you've got different cell phones, and no one can get hold of you. So I want every cell phone that you are using so that we can contact you when there are changes. And your official home address, and other contacts. Now, I do mean that, because we have had too many challenges in this regard. And I'm certainly not going to start running, I don't know what sort of organization. Now, I've got to bring in the hawks to look for people's cell numbers. Right. Now, so that's on track. When it comes to the meeting next week, as you know, I mean, some of us may not always consult the Zed list, but I'm sure you've all heard of the Zed list. Okay. Now, that's this pink document which is floating around here. Just a minute. There we are. Well, not that, but the other one under it. Where is the Zed list? There we are. Well, this is what it looks like, but I know we've all seen it. Now, the Zed list is here, and it says Tuesday the 17th of November, and that is the WTO briefing by the Minister on the conference in Nairobi. The old assembly chamber, we added PAV, all right? And that is the old assembly, and that should go from 8:30 to 10:30, 11 o'clock at the latest. Then on Wednesday the 18th of November, we're also meeting at that time, 8:30, but until 2:30. And then we have the NRCS. These are all second quarterly reports. SIPSI, but I thought we had SIPSI. I think we changed that around. I think the possibility was to try and include maybe CAV there, but the minister wouldn't be available on the Wednesday. You know, and I think that that is a problem. So the SIPSI we've done, you all know that. And the only other one, the NCC, and there we are. So that is in Mark's Building, M315. And I see here, it's also the consideration of the committee program for the first quarter 2016. I am going to do my level best to try and do that, but I'm also hoping the negotiation will be positively resolved so that we can get some support staff to do that. All right, but we will do our best. There we are, that is the 17th and the 18th. On the 19th, it's Thursday. We do not anticipate meeting then, and we do not anticipate meeting on Friday. It's not scheduled. So I do want to thank you, members, for your application to the work at hand. Honourable MacPherson.
Chair, you'll know that Honourable Gil Lewis and I have sent you emails on separate issues, one being that of a goer that the Honourable Gil Lewis has sent, and the application or the email that I had made on MSEP for the Minister to come speak to us. I have not received formal correspondence in that respect, and we'd just like to know if we're going to be discussed, if the Minister is there on Tuesday, if that will be discussed while he's there.
Well, you see, the point is you also asked for CAV, and as you know, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, are not going to be enough time for all of that. That's the challenge we face. So, we have to prioritize. The WTO will go in. MSEP, the DG's been here, and you referred to MSEP. You did raise, or someone raised some questions in regard to MSEP. And it may not be possible because the minister is not available on Wednesday, and we all know that. So, unfortunately, that is something we will have to schedule for the new year, and that's all we can do. When it comes to the other issue, AGOA, I thought the minister, perhaps there, as he's here on Tuesday, he may well refer to it, but I had made a reference to it myself. I
contract. It doesn't come from me. All the ministers.